Case number 20-4222. Melissa Cavallo versus Terry Baldoff. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Fosnot, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, my name is Jerry Fosnot and I represent the warden. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
We ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court. The district court erred by reviewing the prejudice prong de novo and by failing to apply the AEDPA standard of review.
Well, the district judge didn't purport to review it de novo, did she?
She said that the prejudice prong was reviewed de novo, yes.
Oh, the prejudice prong. Oh, okay, not the deficient performance prong.
Right.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay. No problem. And by failing to apply the AEDPA standard of review, which in Richter provides that federal courts should determine what arguments or theories could have supported the state court's decision and ask whether it's possible for fair-minded jurists to disagree that those arguments or theories are inconsistent with the Supreme Court precedent. In footnote 17 of the district court's decision, that the district court acknowledged that there were two decisions from the appellate court in 2011 and 2016. Inexplicably, the district court found that the 2016 decision only addressed deficient performance, which it does not. The court didn't specify which prong it was deciding under because it was essentially deciding whether to affirm a motion for relief from judgment. And the court said that Davila hadn't met the standard for receiving relief. The trial court order that she was seeking relief from judgment was based both on the deficient performance and the prejudice prongs. This court's precedent requiring de novo review of the state court, if the state court doesn't rely on one of the Strickland prongs, is inconsistent with both Strickland and Richter. In Strickland, the Supreme Court said that state courts need not decide on both prongs. If they found that the petitioner had not met one prong, they could end it there. That advice to the state court was taken here. The state court found that Davila had not met the deficient performance standard and they didn't need to decide the prejudice prong.
What if we think this argument's wrong? What if we think that the district court applied the right standard there? What's your next argument? What is your other argument? I'm not sure. The state court seemed to decide the one prong, not the other.
Well, and I would disagree as to the 2016 case. I mean, the 2016 decision, but they did specifically say they were only deciding the deficient performance prong in 2011. However, the decision in Richter, the Supreme Court notes that the decision to focus on cross-examination rather than to retain an expert is a matter of trial strategy, and that's what happened here.
How do you describe the double deference standard? So I've been trying to say it in my mind, but how would you describe the double deference? Do you agree there's double deference in this circumstance?
Yes.
I assumed you would.
I think it applies to both prongs because, as the court said in Richter, you're deciding a claim, not components of a claim.
Okay, but setting that aside, just how would you, even on a deficient performance, I think you're right about the standard, certainly, that we have to give significant deference to the state court. So how do you describe the double deference, like the framework that we're supposed to apply?
The deference is because the state court judgment, the question of whether counsel performed efficiently and prejudiced the defendant, that is a deferential standard itself. Because there's such a broad leeway given to state courts to make their judgments, that's deferential. And then this court has to engage the AEDPA deference onto the state court's judgment that already deferred to a reasonable range of attorney performance that can equate to adequate representation. So
what are the limits? I understand you're going to argue that this was a judgment call by trial counsel. When does something cross the line and it's no longer a judgment call, it's just a really bad call for which the Strickland standard might be met for deficient performance?
I think you'd certainly find it where the defense counsel did nothing, didn't request any discovery, didn't look at the discovery, never talked to anyone or questioned anyone, no witnesses, no...
What's that Supreme Court case? I mean, there is a Supreme Court case with that, is there not?
Well, I mean, I'm not certain. I'd cite Strickland as setting forth the test. I know Yarborough versus Gentry.
We usually look for a case that's on point or close to being on point. I mean, Strickland is a general standard. It's a very generalized standard.
I know Yarborough versus Gentry said that that you don't, like, the Supreme Court had found even Clarence Darrow, who called his clients monsters, was not a deficient attorney.
Well, yeah, I mean, really the closest case to ours is the Harrington versus Rickner case. And that case, the argument was, I think, the same that's made in this case, that you can't just attack the experts on one side, that you have to get an expert to support your position. That's what the argument was, and the Supreme Court rejected it and said no, a matter of a trial strategy could be to simply attack the prosecution's case and argue it didn't establish beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the offense. How did Judge Barker deal with Harrington versus Rickner?
It doesn't appear that she engaged in any analysis of the Harrington versus.
Yeah, she relied on a 2007 case of Ritchie, which I think is in question after Harrington versus Rickner. And I mean, you agree with that? I think Judge Larson wrote an opinion on that.
Right. I definitely agree with that. In addition,
so, counsel. The way the trial court saw it was that this wasn't simply a matter of not getting an expert. It was a matter of not making the necessary inquiries to determine whether cross-examination would be the best approach. That basically what the attorney did was through someone else make informal inquiries of a neurologist and determine from that his best chance was just smoke and mirrors, and that there was no conversation, as I understand, with anyone about the time frame in which this injury had to happen. That basically the lawyer accepted the position that it had to have been between, I don't know, it was within 3 to 5 hours or something like that. And he made no inquiry of anyone. So what about that?
Well, the record does show that he consulted with 3 different doctors, Dr. Clark, Dr. Bartek, and the informal consultation through co-counsel with Dr. Swanson. Now, the state court relies solely on this Dr. Pliopus and engages in no review of the cross-examination of Dr. Pliopus. And he specifically noted, even in his cross-examination, that the theory he presented could not be found in any treatise. He acknowledged that on cross-examination. He also acknowledged he wasn't a forensic pathologist. And the trial court on the post-conviction review said without, or in the motion for relief from judgment, said without presenting the testimony of a doctor with forensic experience, you could not refute the testimony of Dr. Daniels. So in here, even Dr. Pliopus, and they don't have a forensic expert, Dr. Pliopus's standard, he acknowledged, could not be found in a medical treatise. He was merely stating what his opinion was, which could not be found in any medical casebook. In addition,
what's the evidence of guilt in this case? I mean, there's the obvious point that the child was dropped off in the morning, seemingly alive and well, and that's not the case when the child's picked up the other day.
Right.
But is there what else complements that evidence? Such a strange case in my mind where it's just...
There's plenty of objective testimony that he was lethargic all day, right?
That he was sleepy. And Dovala said he had been congested for a few days and had a doctor's appointment the next day. So it's entirely possible this child was sick. But Even Dovla's mother said the child was kicking its legs. Dovla said he ate well. Everything changed apparently at 3 p.m., around 3 p.m., when she couldn't rouse him. And even then, she never called 911. The kid was turning blue, still didn't call 911, and eventually just took the kid out to the mother in the child seat. But the doctors both testified that there was no evidence of white blood cells, there was little evidence of edema, and there was no disintegration of the red blood cells, and that showed that this was a recent injury. And you had no fibrin, and all of that showed that there had been no chance of the baby to heal. So that had to be a recent injury. And that
was a what? A no?
No evidence of the injury to heal. The injury to the head had no time to heal. So if it had been...
But there were also no marks anywhere, right? There was no sign of this supposed hit at the... at the edge of the table or...
Other than the fracture, no. But all the doctors testified that a child's elasticity of the skin allows for an incredible amount of force, and the child's skin elasticity will still allow for there to be no break in the skin. All of the experts testified to that.
Were there no witnesses other than Dovla? Is that the only witness?
Right. And... Interestingly enough, the mother and Dovla tried to later say that maybe Dovla's son had come in and hurt the baby, I guess is what their theory was at trial. But in her statement to the police, she never mentioned this one occurrence. And the mother's statement regarding how this occurred, supposedly at trial they were saying that the kid, she looked, essentially she was doing whatever she was doing, and the kid started screaming, and the son had sat down to, but at her prior statement was, she changed her statement. And the prior statement was that she was sitting 2 feet away, the child came in from another room, knelt down, and said hi. But, and this is the case in a lot of child abuse cases. I mean, when you have a child care provider, there are going to be children and a child care provider. There aren't going to be adult witnesses that are going to testify. And I will ask you to reverse the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions at this time? Judge White? Judge Radler? You'll have your 3 minutes rebuttal. All right. Let's hear from the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is David Duff. I'm for the appellee, Melissa Davila. The court mentioned that the standard in Strickland is general. That the principle is general, and that's important because the court on in Yarbrough versus Alvarado explained the difference between a specific, this court dealt with in Whittle, and a general. In a general, they acknowledged that we're not going to be able to do a case-by-case precedent for what equates to ineffective, that district court judges, because of their experience, will be able to understand reasonable. Reasonable is a legal term. They're all familiar with it. They wouldn't be a district court judge without it. And there would be a range. When you have a general standard, there's a little more of a range, a little more of discretion when you're doing your review. And they acknowledged that the IAC claims would have to be built on a case-by-case basis. The case law would be built up. And they said
the district court's looking at the same record we're looking at. The district court didn't do anything in this case, right? Was there an evidentiary hearing in this case?
No.
That's the district court didn't do anything.
No. Not
whatever lens the district court's looking at, the same ones we're looking at.
But the point I'm
What is the point? I'm sorry.
Well, I think your biggest obstacle here to say that the Ohio Court of Appeals determinations were unreasonable is the fact that the magistrate looking at the same record that we looked at, the magistrate, who is now a federal district judge, said in his opinion that the Ohio Supreme Court's determination were not unreasonable. So here you have fair-minded jurors looking at the same record. One says it's unreasonable, one says it's reasonable. Hence, I don't think you've got EPA.
It's never...
You overcome EPA, that's all.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. The problem with using a numerical analysis is by definition every habeas case will have 1 to 4 to 10 state court judges rule against it or it wouldn't be in federal court. If it was just a numerical, there are other judges disagree, there would be no habeas.
I mean, Judge Griffin was pointing to another federal judge that...
Yeah.
No, I understand.
But the federal magistrate said that the Ohio Supreme Court's determinations were not an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court. And under AEDPA, we're supposed to determine whether all fair-minded jurors would view the case the same way as an unreasonable application. And if all reasonable jurors would say it's an unreasonable application, well, you win. But if there's a disagreement among fair-minded jurors, which we have here with the magistrate, you don't win, you lose, right?
Here's where I disagree with that.
Okay, well, okay. Tell me why.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, but the problem is that if the standard isn't addressed, in this case, it's Wiggins. Wiggins,
it's what? Wiggins?
It's the Wiggins case. It's in this case, in Wiggins, these facts aren't materially different than Wiggins. In Wiggins, it was a death penalty case, but the issue was when you're talking about strategy. Here, for Melissa, the issue was it a reasonable strategy to just rely on cross-examination? What Wiggins says, the Supreme Court in Wiggins says, the focus isn't on what was done. The focus isn't on, how they did or the answers or whether he had it effective. The focus is on the preparation, the investigation that the defense counsel made in determining the strategy. And if he didn't or she didn't do a complete investigation, which may or may not include an expert, then the decision is per se unreasonable. Once you get that it's unreasonable, then you go on to the prejudice.
Don't you have to show that? I mean, you have to show there was a lack of investigation that would have led to something.
Yes.
If it was just a total rabbit hole, that wasn't going to lead to anything. So what's your lead to here?
Well,
I mean, your best case, or the point you think that should have been pursued more aggressively, is that this injury could have occurred earlier.
Well, no.
Before the child got to the daycare center, right? And it was like a late onset injury? No?
The point that should have been addressed more aggressively, particularly in the state court, was the inferior and in lack of investigation.
Well, but doesn't the investigation have to lead to something? I mean, don't you have to tell us what? I'm trying to figure out what the investigation would have led to, how you're presenting that case, and how that was both deficient and prejudicial.
What we know from the autopsy in the ER or the EMS records, there's no bruising. You know, there was no coup or contra coup. This in the opinion couldn't have been a direct impact, because you'd had some sort of surface bleeding. Also, the expert disagreed with that it was a hemorrhage. This was caused by the injury from direct impact. There was hemorrhaging that had the child had immediate care, that the child might have been saved, that the heart arrhythmia was caused by the hemorrhage. The point of the four-year-old being there was on a child that young, that it didn't take much pressure, that the brain platelets and stuff hadn't attached, it wouldn't take a lot of pressure or a squeeze or something to the eye to cause the hemorrhaging. And so this was...
What are you getting at? What's another explanation? I mean, I, as I said, your friend on the other side, it's a really strange case. There's not a lot of, hardly any direct evidence, just a couple pieces of circumstantial evidence. So what is your explanation? What defense should counsel put on for your client, that this was caused by a four-year-old for which your client's not liable, or caused before the child reached the daycare center?
First of all, he didn't have to prove. What they argued, what the doctor argued, was that it could have been the four-year-old. The four-year-old was there. He wasn't being watched. It wouldn't take a lot of pressure, and the doctor in his affidavit said absolutely a four-year-old could cause that pressure.
If it's the four-year-old, is that a negligent homicide or manslaughter?
Under Ohio law.
Your client was convicted of a number of offenses.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and I don't have the statute in front of you, but obviously if she was reckless or careless in not watching...
Wasn't that one of the charges she was convicted of?
It wouldn't be murder. But it wouldn't be a purposeful killing.
So the lowest offense that she was convicted of was not wasn't a manslaughter, or wasn't she convicted of four offenses?
Yeah, they all merged into murder. And the point is, the jury didn't have
the opposing investigator, they didn't have another opinion. You know, when you, with a problem when you talk to the doctor that, you know, that he asked, he came up with after supposedly reading these treatises, that there was a genetic mutation, in which the lawyer said, yeah, that's crap. He said in his deposition it was crap. The problem with that is that he, you know, the expert for the state said, well, remote. And then supposedly that shows his effectiveness. It can't be. In fact, under Ohio law, the reasonable doubt instruction specifically says, in the state of human affairs, there's always some doubt. You know, there's always, and so basically when you say it's remote, it's having the jury exclude it. So it's not the effectiveness of his cross. But that's not the point. The point is the investigation. No money was ever paid to an expert. No expert said they had.
I thought there was $2,000 paid to somebody or other.
But he didn't look at all the, all of them said, I didn't look at the material.
Oh, okay, but there wasn't there $2,000 paid to one expert? See if I can.
Well, he had an OBGYN, which of course I don't know how that would be helpful in this case.
Yeah, I think that's where the money went for that. There were no reports, I know.
In the point, and he actually misled the client, said, well, these people are agreeing. That wasn't the case. All of the experts said, well, for instance, the husband of the wife said, oh, yeah, maybe it sounds like blunt impact, but hadn't looked at anything. She just
maybe what?
Just a brief conversation, and for a lawyer to rely upon that for not making further inquiry. This was a brain injury. When you have a homicide, the number one, the first thing you do is determine the cause of death. That's the first thing that you do. Yeah. And when you're just not talking, it's a brain injury, and he did not sit down and provide all of the records to a neurologist.
Just for the record, my notes say that defense counsel paid Dr. Francis Barkett, B-A-R-T-E-K, $2,000. You don't dispute that, do you?
No.
Okay.
Do anything. That's
all right, but you told me he didn't pay any money, and that I think that was an incorrect assertion.
But relatively for experts that are charging.
Okay, the other problem about the theory of this 5-year-old, 4-year-old doing it was that your client early on told the police that there were no other suspects that could have done this, and she made quite clear statements or admissions that there was nobody else there. I mean, that's correct, isn't it? And defense counsel was saddled with those admissions by his client once he got the case. I mean, before he came into the case, she had already said there weren't other suspects. Isn't that correct? And that limited his strategies.
Wasn't she asked that question in the... I'm sorry. Wasn't she basically told by the police what the relevant time frame was?
Yes, and at least my point of the lack of investigation. A key thing that I'll call him Dr. P noted was it came out that the defense attorney didn't even know the time frame. He thought it was spontaneous until the actual testimony in court. But what the defense expert said is, I don't know why we're limited to 3 to 5 hours. This could have happened before she was brought there. That's a key point. It didn't have to have happened at the place, at the nurse. When he came in, he was lethargic all day. And the key thing, if you have an expert and you put on an expert, this could have happened before they even got to the daycare
center. So it's not a 4-year-old. I mean, it's like,
no,
I asked you for what your best theory was. You told me it was the 4-year-old while the child's at the center, but this testimony totally blows up that defense in a lot of ways, and so now you're going to a different argument.
No.
Well, I thought you were going to. Okay, maybe.
No, I'm sorry if I didn't.
I thought you were moving to the injury occurred. Can I finish? I thought you were moving to the injury. Well, usually it's just better. I thought you were moving to the child was injured before the child got to the, which is different than the 4-year-old at the facility, right?
You asked, and if I misunderstood your question, I apologize. You asked based on the evidence at trial. What was the best that was there? This is post-conviction evidence. The point being that by not having a thorough investigation, you're right. The lawyer was handcuffed and was stuck with what he thought was a spontaneous injury.
I'm just trying to figure out what you thought about what he should have investigated, I guess. And the 4-year-old committing the unfortunate act
while the child is at the facility, has to be hurdled, the hurdle that Judge Griffin pointed out, to overcome.
But that's not what I'm arguing. It was in it, that was a possibility stated by the doctor, but he also stated that it was wrong to put this time frame. It could have been as much as 12 hours before, and in fact, it could have happened before it even got to the detention.
Yeah, and I thought that was your best point. I thought that was probably the best point you had.
I misunderstood. I thought you meant based on what came in at trial, so I apologize for that. But that's the point. As a defense attorney, one, you have to figure out the cause, and two, you create reasonable doubt. Obviously, calling in an expert in expanding the time, in expanding the time to a point that it may not have happened even there because there were no witnesses, there's no security cameras, there's no injuries, there's no bruises, obviously, that's going to create doubt.
Yeah, but wasn't the expert a little wobbly on that point? Said it, you know, it's possible it could have occurred earlier or much earlier, but a little bit wobbly on that. And why don't we defer to the judgment of counsel that pursuing that defense may have been a stretch and may have hurt the overall case? In other words, if they pursue a defense or they pursue a different theory that's, seems a little bit incredible that might hurt the client's overall defense.
So I'm clear, which you mean before she got there?
Yeah, the injury occurred before the child got to the center.
Well, the point of Wiggins is that before you can, it might be, had he talked to the experts and the experts said, you know, concurred with Dr. Mattis, the pathologist, then maybe it's a reasonable decision. But because he didn't talk to him, he knew no alternative. He kind of created one that even he said was crap to do it instead of conferring with people that and showing him all the records that had neurological background. That's the first step. When he didn't do it, that violated, it can't be a reasonable strategy by Wiggins' definition. That's exactly what they said. And Wiggins, the lawyer didn't come to further explanation, and there was sexual abuse that he didn't go into. And they were saying, well, it might be reasonable not to go there because it might not have been supported that much. And the court specifically said, you don't need to go there. The fact that he didn't know it, that he didn't investigate it, that violates the duty prong. Then you move on to the prejudice prong. And the prejudice prong, obviously, is de novo because the state court specifically said they didn't need to do that. And even if they violated Wiggins, it's still de novo. So the deference doesn't really matter.
So your post-conviction expert disagreed with the mechanism of death or the...
Yes.
Okay, and did the lawyer investigate that?
No. The lawyer, this was part of the problem. May I finish my time?
Sure.
Part of the problem was when, you know, the court mentioned this is an experienced lawyer for a lot of homicides. When you have a direct blunt instrument, there would be an injury of some sort, maybe a cut, at least bruising, and or coup or contra coup, which is when the brain shakes and it's on the other side. When you see no bruising or no injury, and that's verified on the EMS records, the first thing you do, how could this person have died with a head injury and there's no direct blunt instrument, there's no serious? That's what was failed to be investigated fully.
Well, but there was testimony that with a young child like that, you do get an amount of elasticity that could explain that, right?
Can I finish that one?
Did the prosecutor present evidence that with a baby that young, you can have a situation where there's internal injury when there are no marks on the outside?
I don't remember specific testimony by either doctor stating that.
Okay, and which do you think is more significant? The failure to explore the time frame or this different method of injury?
Well, both. they go together. It's a cumulative error. Because if you had an expert talk about how the injury occurred and it's explained that this is from internal bleeding caused by, you know, compression, that in turn would extend the time period in which this could have happened. So they go together. I don't know that you can...
Okay, but the post-conviction expert did say that it was an inflicted injury.
Yes, there had to be some sort of compression, which compression is obviously inflicted. It wasn't a fall-down case. He didn't say that. That's correct.
All right. And regarding your claim of failing to investigate, do you agree that you are bound by the factual findings as to the counsel's investigation as made by the Ohio Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not arguing that their factual findings are clear and convincing error?
The court is right. I may disagree, but the standard
okay.
is what the court says.
Okay, very, very good. All right, any further questions? Thank you for your argument and your representation, too. All right, let's hear from the warden, 3 minutes rebuttal.
Okay. As the state witnesses testified, there was no time for bruising because the injury occurred so quickly. They said that there was no white blood cells, there's no fibrin. I mentioned that previously. No contrecoup. The state experts also testified on a five-month-old, the skull is very flexible and soft, so there would not necessarily be that in this case. The defense expert in post-conviction at page ID 2046 said it would require still considerable force. He acknowledged the four-year-old could have done it, but he still said it would be considerable force even in that case. But this other issue regarding her son, she never mentioned it in her interview with the police. She was just detailing everything that happened with Riley all day and never once mentioned that Riley screamed out in pain at some point early on in the morning.
But she wasn't there then, right? Her mother was there.
She was there. Her mother even said that, supposedly, and there were two different stories, but her mother said that once the child screamed and couldn't be calmed down for 10 minutes, Melissa called down from upstairs and then came and got Riley and took Riley to bed after that. Melissa was there. She was getting her daughter to take her to the doctor's office.
But she wasn't there. She was upstairs. Right.
But you would hear the child screaming and not being able to be calmed down for 10 minutes. She never mentioned this. She did mention it at trial, but she never mentioned it to the police officers in her statement. The subjective statements regarding whether counsel was successful, the courts have been very clear, Strickland's objective, not subjective.
Can I ask you on the timing? Judge White asked your friend on the other side about whether the timing argument was stronger or sort of the cause of injury, this medical science. I thought the timing was a little more compelling. Is your response to that counsel did investigate it and just made a judgment that it wasn't significant, or that this timing argument really had no legs and so there was no reason to investigate?
I think he realized that after his investigation. I mean, there is evidence. He reviewed all the materials that he was given. He consulted with three different doctors. He even cited in the cross-examination of the state's witnesses like 12 treatises and journal articles in cross-examining the witnesses. Specifically, went after Dr. Mattis for not being a forensic pathologist, and then that caused the state to go out and get a forensic pathologist, it was somebody from the coroner's office, but to bring that person in because the defense counsel had made that an issue at trial. So I think the evidence shows he was looking at all of this, and based on Dovla's statement and the evidence and the testimony from the state's witness, he had nothing to go on with regard to saying that the injury happened anywhere before. As Melissa Dovla even said, nothing changed really regarding Riley until after 3 p.m.
I'm not sure I really heard your answer. He consulted all these people, but please tell me, whom did he consult on the timing, on that window?
I would imagine it was in the medical testimony, the expert's testimony, the autopsy report, and...
What expert did he consult to determine whether this very narrow window that the police had basically proposed initially, and that the prosecution was putting forward. With whom did he consult to see whether that was correct or not?
I think he said on post-conviction that he did not ask any of the experts regarding the timing, but there is nothing in the case law, no Supreme Court precedent that requires an expert to ask and requires a defense counsel to ask an expert regarding timing or you're deemed deficient and prejudicial to your client.
Can you possibly know what you're dealing with if you don't sort of verify that very basic piece of information? There was a homicide, and you need to know what is the range during which it could happen.
He had years of experience, and he had the medical information that he researched, and there's nothing to say that that's insufficient. In addition, again, going back to the defense expert even says, you will find nothing in the treatises regarding my theory. You cannot look in the index of a medical journal or a medical book and find what I am arguing here today. He said that on cross-examination. So what they're saying is essentially that Dovala should have brought in this neurologist to testify and be cross-examined and have to admit on the stand, there's no medical basis for my statement to you.
Wait, is that the same thing? There's no medical basis for what I'm saying, or...
Well, if you can't
I cannot tell you that that you're going to find this in the medical book.
Well, you're asking for where you can go to an expert to ask for something. They would have been trained in a book, using a book, and then in practice, and for a doctor to come on. And we're saying that James Burge, his theory was smoke and mirrors, and I had nothing, and the medical evidence is against my theory that I argued to the jury. And now Dovala is trying to present a doctor that is going to tell the jury the exact same thing. There's nothing in a medical book that I can show you that will provide support for what I'm telling you today.
All right.
We ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district.
Any further questions, Judge Rader? All right. Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted. We're going to have some brief cleaning of counsel table at this time before we call the next case, so you may do your cleaning.
Thank you. You may take a seat, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.